Leibniz based his philosophy upon two logical premises, the law of contradiction and the law of sufficient reason. Both depend upon the notion of an analytic proposition, which is one in which the predicate is contained in the subject. For instance, all white men are men. The law of contradiction states that all analytic propositions are true. The law of sufficient reason, in the esoteric system only, states that all true propositions are analytic. This applies even to what we should regard as empirical statements about matters of fact. If I make a journey, the notion of me must from all eternity have included the notion of this journey, which is a predicate of me. We may say that the nature of an individual substance, or complete being, is to have a notion so completed that it suffices to comprehend and to render deducible from it all the predicates of the subject to which this notion is attributed. Thus, the quality of king, which belongs to Alexander the Great, abstracting from the subject, is not sufficiently determined for an individual and does not involve other qualities of the same subject, nor all that the notion of this prince contains. Whereas God, seeing the individual notion or hexeity of Alexander, sees in it at the same time the foundation and the reason of all the predicates which can be truly attributed to him, as, for example, whether he would conquer Darius and Porus, even to knowing a priori and not by experience whether he died a natural death or by poison, which we can only know by history. One of the most definite statements of the basis of his metaphysic occurs in a letter to Arnauld. In consulting the notion which I have of every true proposition, I find that every predicate, necessary or contingent, past, present, or future, is comprised in the notion of the subject, and I ask no more. The proposition in question is of great importance and deserves to be well established, for it follows that every soul is as a world apart, independent of everything else except God, that it is not only immortal, and so to speak, impassable, but that it keeps in its substance traces of all that happens to it. He goes on to explain that substances do not act on each other, but agree through all mirroring the universe, each from its own point of view. There can be no interaction because all that happens to each substance is part of its own notion and eternally determined if that substance exists. This system is evidently just as deterministic as that of Spinoza. Arnauld expresses his horror of the statement, which Leibniz had made, that the individual notion of each person involves once for all everything that will ever happen to him. Such a view is evidently incompatible with the Christian doctrine of sin and free will. Finding it ill-received by Arnauld, Leibniz carefully refrained from making it public. For human beings, it is true, there is a difference between truths known by logic and truths known by experience. This difference arises in two ways. In the first place, although everything that happens to Adam follows from his notion, if he exists, we can only ascertain his existence by experience. In the second place, the notion of any individual substance is infinitely complex, and the analysis required to deduce his predicates is only possible for God. These differences, however, are only due to our ignorance and intellectual limitation. For God, they do not exist. God apprehends the notion of Adam in all its infinite complexity, and can therefore see all true propositions about Adam as analytic. God can also ascertain a priori whether Adam exists. For God knows his own goodness, from which it follows that he will create the best possible world. And he also knows whether or not Adam forms part of this world. There is therefore no real escape from determinism through our ignorance. There is, however, a further point which is very curious. At most times, Leibniz represents the creation as a free act of God, requiring the exercise of his will. According to this doctrine, the determination of what actually exists is not affected by observation, but must proceed by way of God's goodness. Apart from God's goodness, which leads him to create the best possible world, there is no a priori reason why one thing should exist rather than another. But sometimes, in papers not shown to any human being, there is a quite different theory as to why some things exist and others, equally possible, do not. According to this view, everything that does not exist struggles to exist, but not all possibles can exist because they are not all compossible. it may be possible that A should exist, and also possible that B should exist, but not possible that both A and B should exist. In that case, A and B are not compossible. Two or more things are only compossible when it is possible for all of them to exist. Leibniz seems to have imagined a sort of war in the limbo inhabited by essences all trying to exist. In this war, groups of compossibles combine, and the largest group of compossibles wins, like the largest pressure group in a political contest. Leibniz even uses this conception as a way of defining existence. He says, "The existent may be defined as that which is compatible with more things than is anything incompatible with itself." That is to say, if A is incompatible with B, while A is compatible with C and D and E, but B is only compatible with F and G, then A, but not B, exists by definition. The existent, he said, is the being which is compatible with the most things. In this account, there is no mention of God, and apparently no act of creation. Nor is there need of anything but pure logic for determining what exists. The question whether A and B are compossible is, for Leibniz, a logical question, namely, does the existence of both A and B involve a contradiction? It follows that, in theory, logic can decide the question what group of compossibles is the largest, and this group, consequently, will exist. Perhaps, however, Leibniz did not really mean that the above was a definition of existence. If it was merely a criterion, it can be reconciled with his popular views by means of what he calls metaphysical perfection. Metaphysical perfection, as he uses the term, seems to mean quantity of existence. It is, he says, nothing but the magnitude of positive reality strictly understood. He always argues that God created as much as possible. This is one of his reasons for rejecting a vacuum. There is a general belief, which I have never understood, that it is better to exist than not to exist. On this ground, children are exhorted to be grateful to their parents. Leibniz evidently held this view and thought it part of God's goodness to create as full a universe as possible. It would follow that the actual world would consist of the largest group of compossibles. It would still be true that logic alone, given a sufficiently able logician, could decide whether a given possible substance would exist or not. Leibniz, in his private thinking, is the best example of a philosopher who uses logic as a key to metaphysics. This type of philosophy begins with Parmenides, and is carried further in Plato's use of the theory of ideas to prove various extra-logical propositions. Spinoza belongs to the same type, and so does Hegel. But none of these is so clear-cut as Leibniz in drawing inferences from syntax to the real world. This kind of argumentation has fallen into disrepute owing to the growth of empiricism. Whether any valid inferences are possible from language to non-linguistic facts is a question as to which I do not care to dogmatize. But certainly, the inferences found in Leibniz and other a priori philosophers are not valid, since all are due to a defective logic. The subject-predicate logic, which all such philosophers in the past assumed, either ignores relations altogether or produces fallacious arguments to prove that relations are unreal. Leibniz is guilty of a special inconsistency in combining the subject-predicate logic with pluralism, for the proposition, "there are many monads," is not of the subject-predicate form. To be consistent, a philosopher who believes all propositions to be of this form should be a monist, like Spinoza. Leibniz rejected monism, largely owing to his interest in dynamics, and to his argument that extension involves repetition and therefore cannot be an attribute of a single substance. Leibniz is a dull writer, and his effect on German philosophy was to make it pedantic and arid. His disciple, Wolff, who dominated the German universities until the publication of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, left out whatever was most interesting in Leibniz and produced a dry, professorial way of thinking. Outside Germany, Leibniz's philosophy had little influence. His contemporary Locke governed British philosophy, while in France Descartes continued to reign until he was overthrown by Voltaire, who made English empiricism fashionable. Nevertheless, Leibniz remains a great man, and his greatness is more apparent now than it was at any earlier time. Apart from his eminence as a mathematician, and as the inventor of the infinitesimal calculus, he was a pioneer in mathematical logic, of which he perceived the importance when no one else did so. And his philosophical hypotheses, though fantastic, are very clear and capable of precise expression. Even his monads can still be useful as suggesting possible ways of viewing perception, though they cannot be regarded as windowless. What I, for my part, think best in his theory of monads is his two kinds of space, one subjective in the perceptions of each monad, and one objective, consisting of the assemblage of points of view of the various monads. This, I believe, is still useful in relating perception to physics. Chapter 12. Philosophical Liberalism. The rise of liberalism in politics and philosophy provides material for the study of a very general and very important question, namely, what has been the influence of political and social circumstances upon the thoughts of eminent and original thinkers, and conversely, what has been the influence of these men upon subsequent political and social developments? Two opposite errors, both common, are to be guarded against. On the one hand, men who are more familiar with books than with affairs are apt to overestimate the influence of philosophers. When they see some political party proclaiming itself inspired by so-and-so's teaching, they think its actions are attributable to so-and-so, whereas, not infrequently, the philosopher is only acclaimed because he recommends what the party would have done in any case. Writers of books, until recently, almost all exaggerated the effects of their predecessors in the same trade. But conversely, a new error has arisen by a reaction against the old one, and this new error consists in regarding theorists as almost passive products of their circumstances, and as having hardly any influence at all upon the course of events. Ideas, according to this view, are the froth on the surface of deep currents, which are determined by material and technical causes. Social changes are no more caused by thought than the flow of a river is caused by the bubbles that reveal its direction to an onlooker. For my part, I believe that the truth lies between these two extremes. Between ideas and practical life, as everywhere else, there is reciprocal interaction. To ask which is cause and which effect is as futile as the problem of the hen and the egg. I shall not waste time upon a discussion of this question in the abstract, but shall consider historically one important case of the general question, namely, the development of liberalism and its offshoots from the end of the 17th century to the present day. Early liberalism was a product of England and Holland, and had certain well-marked characteristics. It stood for religious toleration. It was Protestant, but of a latitudinarian rather than of a fanatical kind. It regarded the wars of religion as silly. It valued commerce and industry, and favoured the rising middle class rather than the monarchy and the aristocracy. It had immense respect for the rights of property, especially when accumulated by the labours of the individual possessor. The hereditary principle, though not rejected, was restricted in scope more than it had previously been. In particular, the divine right of kings was rejected in favour of the view that every community has a right, at any rate initially, to choose its own form of government. Implicitly, the tendency of early liberalism was towards democracy tempered by the rights of property. There was a belief, not at first wholly explicit, that all men are born equal, and that their subsequent inequality is a product of circumstances. This led to a great emphasis upon the importance of education as opposed to congenital characteristics. There was a certain bias against government, because governments almost everywhere were in the hands of kings or aristocracies, who seldom either understood or respected the needs of merchants. But this bias was held in check by the hope that the necessary understanding and respect would be won before long. Early liberalism was optimistic, energetic, and philosophic, because it represented growing forces which appeared likely to become victorious without great difficulty, and to bring by their victory great benefits to mankind. It was opposed to everything medieval, both in philosophy and in politics, because medieval theories had been used to sanction the powers of church and king, to justify persecution, and to obstruct the rise of science. But it was opposed equally to the then modern fanaticisms of Calvinists and Anabaptists. It wanted an end to political and theological strife in order to liberate energies for the exciting enterprises of commerce and science, such as the East India Company and the Bank of England, the theory of gravitation and the discovery of the circulation of the blood. Throughout the Western world, bigotry was giving place to enlightenment. The fear of Spanish power was ending, all classes were increasing in prosperity, and the highest hopes appeared to be warranted by the most sober judgment. For 100 years, nothing occurred to dim these hopes. Then at last, they themselves generated the French Revolution, which led directly to Napoleon and thence to the Holy Alliance. After these events, liberalism had to acquire its second wind before the renewed optimism of the 19th century became possible. Before embarking upon any detail, it will be well to consider the general pattern of the liberal movements from the 17th to the 19th century. This pattern is at first simple, but grows gradually more and more complex. The distinctive character of the whole movement is, in a certain wide sense, individualism, but this is a vague term until further defined. The philosophers of Greece, down to and including Aristotle, were not individualists in the sense in which I wish to use the term. They thought of a man as essentially a member of a community. Plato's Republic, for example, is concerned to define the good community, not the good individual. With the loss of political liberty from the time of Alexander onwards, individualism developed and was represented by the Cynics and Stoics. According to the Stoic philosophy, a man could live a good life in no matter what social circumstances. This was also the view of Christianity, especially before it acquired control of the state. But in the Middle Ages, while mystics kept alive the original individualistic trends in Christian ethics, the outlook of most men, including the majority of philosophers, was dominated by a firm synthesis of dogma, law, and custom, which caused men's theoretical beliefs and practical morality to be controlled by a social institution, namely the Catholic Church. What was true and what was good was to be ascertained not by solitary thought, but by the collective wisdom of councils. The first important breach in this system was made by Protestantism, which asserted that general councils may err. To determine the truth thus became no longer a social but an individual enterprise. Since different individuals reached different conclusions, the result was strife, and theological decisions were sought, no longer in assemblies of bishops, but on the battlefield. Since neither party was able to extirpate the other, it became evident, in the end, that a method must be found of reconciling intellectual and ethical individualism with ordered social life. This was one of the main problems which early liberalism attempted to solve. Meanwhile, individualism had penetrated into philosophy. Descartes' fundamental certainty, "I think, therefore I am," made the basis of knowledge different for each person, since for each the starting point was his own existence, not that of other individuals or of the community. His emphasis upon the reliability of clear and distinct ideas tended in the same direction, since it is by introspection that we think we discover whether our ideas are clear and distinct. Most philosophy since Descartes has had this intellectually individualistic aspect in a greater or less degree. There are, however, various forms of this general position which have in practice very different consequences. The outlook of the typical scientific discoverer has perhaps the smallest dose of individualism. When he arrives at a new theory, he does so solely because it seems right to him. He does not bow to authority, for if he did, he would continue to accept the theories of his predecessors. At the same time, his appeal is to generally received canons of truth, and he hopes to persuade other men, not by his authority, but by arguments which are convincing to them as individuals. In science, any clash between the individual and society is in essence transitory, since men of science, broadly speaking, all accept the same intellectual standards, and therefore debate and investigation usually produce agreement in the end. This, however, is a modern development. In the time of Galileo, the authority of Aristotle and the Church was still considered at least as cogent as the evidence of the senses. This shows how the element of individualism in scientific method, though not prominent, is nevertheless essential. Early liberalism was individualistic in intellectual matters and also in economics, but was not emotionally or ethically self-assertive. This form of liberalism dominated the English 18th century, the founders of the American Constitution, and the French encyclopedists. During the French Revolution, it was represented by the more moderate parties, including the Girondins, but with their extermination it disappeared for a generation from French politics. In England, after the Napoleonic Wars, it again became influential with the rise of the Benthamites and the Manchester School. Its greatest success has been in America, where, unhampered by feudalism and a state church, it has been dominant from 1776 to the present day, or at any rate to 1933. A new movement, which has gradually developed into the antithesis of liberalism, begins with Rousseau and acquires strength from the Romantic movement and the principle of nationality. In this movement, individualism is extended from the intellectual sphere to that of the passions, and the anarchic aspects of individualism are made explicit. The cult of the hero, as developed by Carlyle and Nietzsche, is typical of this philosophy. Various elements were combined in it. There was dislike of early industrialism, hatred of the ugliness that it produced, and revulsion against its cruelties. There was a nostalgia for the Middle Ages, which were idealized owing to hatred of the modern world. There was an attempt to combine championship of the fading privileges of church and aristocracy with defense of wage earners against the tyranny of manufacturers. There was a vehement assertion of the right of rebellion in the name of nationalism, and of the splendor of war in defense of liberty. Byron was the poet of this movement. Fichte, Carlyle, and Nietzsche were its philosophers. But since we cannot all have the career of heroic leaders, and cannot all make our individual will prevail, this philosophy, like all other forms of anarchism, inevitably leads, when adopted, to the despotic government of the most successful hero. And when his tyranny is established, he will suppress in others the self-assertive ethic by which he has risen to power. This whole theory of life, therefore, is self-refuting, in the sense that its adoption in practice leads to the realization of something utterly different, a dictatorial state in which the individual is severely repressed. There is yet another philosophy, which in the main is an offshoot of liberalism, namely that of Marx. I shall consider him at a later stage, but for the moment he is merely to be borne in mind. The first comprehensive statement of the liberal philosophy is to be found in Locke, the most influential, though by no means the most profound, of modern philosophers. In England, his views were so completely in harmony with those of most intelligent men that it is difficult to trace their influence except in theoretical philosophy. In France, on the other hand, where they led to an opposition to the existing regime in practice and to the prevailing Cartesianism in theory, they clearly had a considerable effect in shaping the course of events. This is an example of a general principle, a philosophy developed in a politically and economically advanced country, which is, in its birthplace, little more than a clarification and systematization of prevalent opinion, may become elsewhere a source of revolutionary ardor and, ultimately, of actual revolution. It is mainly through theorists that the maxims regulating the policy of advanced countries become known to less advanced countries. In the advanced countries, practice inspires theory. In the others, theory inspires practice. This difference is one of the reasons why transplanted ideas are seldom so successful as they were in their native soil. Before considering the philosophy of Locke, let us review some of the circumstances in 17th century England that were influential in forming his opinions. The conflict between King and Parliament in the Civil War gave Englishmen, once for all, a love of compromise and moderation, and a fear of pushing any theory to its logical conclusion, which has dominated them down to the present time. The principles for which the Long Parliament contended had at first the support of a large majority. They wished to abolish the King's right to grant trade monopolies, and to make him acknowledge the exclusive right of Parliament to impose taxes. They desired liberty within the Church of England for opinions and practices which were persecuted by Archbishop Laud. They held that Parliament should meet at stated intervals, and should not be convoked only on rare occasions when the King found its collaboration indispensable. They objected to arbitrary arrest, and to the subservience of the judges to the royal wishes. But many, while prepared to agitate for these ends, were not prepared to levy war against the king, which appeared to them an act of treason and impiety. As soon as actual war broke out, the division of forces became more nearly equal. The political development from the outbreak of the Civil War to the establishment of Cromwell as Lord Protector followed the course which has now become familiar, but was then unprecedented. The parliamentary party consisted of two factions, the Presbyterians and the Independents. The Presbyterians desired to preserve a state church, but to abolish bishops. The Independents agreed with them about bishops, but held that each congregation should be free to choose its own theology, without the interference of any central ecclesiastical government. The Presbyterians in the main were of a higher social class than the Independents, and their political opinions were more moderate. They wished to come to terms with the king as soon as defeat had made him conciliatory. Their policy, however, was rendered impossible by two circumstances. First, the king developed a martyr's stubbornness about bishops. Second, the defeat of the king proved difficult and was only achieved by Cromwell's new model army, which consisted of Independents. Consequently, when the king's military resistance was broken, he could still not be induced to make a treaty, and the Presbyterians had lost the preponderance of armed forces in the parliamentary armies. The defense of democracy had thrown power into the hands of a minority, and it used its power with a complete disregard for democracy and parliamentary government. When Charles I had attempted to arrest the five members, there had been a universal outcry, and his failure had made him ridiculous. But Cromwell had no such difficulties. By Pride's purge, he dismissed about 100 Presbyterian members and obtained for a time a subservient majority. When finally he decided to dismiss Parliament altogether, not a dog barked. War had made only military force seem important and had produced a contempt for constitutional forms. For the rest of Cromwell's life, the government of England was a military tyranny, hated by an increasing majority of the nation, but impossible to shake off while his partisans alone were armed. Charles II, after hiding in oak trees and living as a refugee in Holland, determined at the Restoration that he would not again set out on his travels. This imposed a certain moderation. He claimed no power to impose taxes not sanctioned by Parliament. He assented to the Habeas Corpus Act, which deprived the Crown of the power of arbitrary arrest. On occasion, he could flout the fiscal power of Parliament by means of subsidies from Louis XIV, but in the main he was a constitutional monarch. Most of the limitations of royal power, originally desired by the opponents of Charles I, were conceded at the Restoration and were respected by Charles II because it had been shown that kings could be made to suffer at the hands of their subjects. James II, unlike his brother, was totally destitute of subtlety and finesse. By his bigoted Catholicism, he united against himself the Anglicans and Nonconformists, in spite of his attempts to conciliate the latter by granting them toleration in defiance of Parliament. Foreign policy also played a part. The Stuarts, in order to avoid the taxation required in wartime, which would have made them dependent upon Parliament, pursued a policy of subservience, first to Spain and then to France. The growing power of France roused the invariable English hostility to the leading continental state, and the revocation of the Edict of Nantes made Protestant feeling bitterly opposed to Louis XIV. In the end, almost everybody in England wished to be rid of James. But almost everybody was equally determined to avoid a return to the days of the Civil War and Cromwell's dictatorship. Since there was no constitutional way of getting rid of James, there must be a revolution, but it must be quickly ended so as to give no opportunity for disruptive forces. The rights of Parliament must be secured once for all. The king must go, but monarchy must be preserved. It should be, however, not a monarchy of divine right, but one dependent upon legislative sanction, and so upon Parliament. By a combination of aristocracy and big business, all this was achieved in a moment, without the necessity of firing a shot. Compromise and moderation had succeeded after every form of intransigence had been tried and had failed. The new king, being Dutch, brought with him the commercial and theological wisdom for which his country was noted. The Bank of England was created, the national debt was made into a secure investment, no longer liable to repudiation at the caprice of the monarch. The Act of Toleration, while leaving Catholics and Nonconformists subject to various disabilities, put an end to actual persecution. Foreign policy became resolutely anti-French and remained so, with brief intermissions until the defeat of Napoleon. Chapter 13. Locke's Theory of Knowledge. John Locke, 1632 to 1704, is the apostle of the Revolution of 1688, the most moderate and the most successful of all revolutions. Its aims were modest, but they were exactly achieved. and no subsequent revolution has hitherto been found necessary in England. Locke faithfully embodies its spirit, and most of his works appeared within a few years of 1688. His chief work in theoretical philosophy, The Essay Concerning Human Understanding, was finished in 1687 and published in 1690. His first letter on toleration was originally published in Latin in 1689 in Holland, to which country Locke had found it prudent to withdraw in 1683. Two further letters on toleration were published in 1690 and 1692. His two treatises on government were licensed for printing in 1689 and published soon afterwards. His book on education was published in 1693. Although his life was long, all his influential writings are confined to the few years from 1687 to 1693. Successful revolutions are stimulating to those who believe in them. Locke's father was a Puritan who fought on the side of Parliament. In the time of Cromwell, when Locke was at Oxford, the university was still scholastic in its philosophy. Locke disliked both scholasticism and the fanaticism of the Independents. He was much influenced by Descartes. He became a physician, and his patron was Lord Shaftesbury, Dryden's Achitophel. When Shaftesbury fell in 1683, Locke fled with him to Holland and remained there until the Revolution. After the Revolution, except for a few years during which he was employed at the Board of Trade, his life was devoted to literary work and to numerous controversies arising out of his books. The years before the Revolution of 1688, when Locke could not, without grave risk, take any part, theoretical or practical, in English politics, were spent by him in composing his Essay on the Human Understanding. This is his most important book, and the one upon which his fame most securely rests. But his influence on the philosophy of politics was so great and so lasting that he must be treated as the founder of philosophical liberalism as much as of empiricism in theory of knowledge. Locke is the most fortunate of all philosophers. He completed his work in theoretical philosophy just at the moment when the government of his country fell into the hands of men who shared his political opinions. Both in practice and in theory, the views which he advocated were held for many years to come by the most vigorous and influential politicians and philosophers. His political doctrines, with the developments due to Montesquieu, are embedded in the American Constitution and are to be seen at work whenever there is a dispute between President and Congress. The British Constitution was based upon his doctrines until about 50 years ago, and so was that which the French adopted in 1871. His influence in 18th century France, which was immense, was primarily due to Voltaire, who, as a young man, spent some time in England and interpreted English ideas to his compatriots in the Lettres Philosophiques. The philosophes and the moderate reformers followed him. The extreme revolutionaries followed Rousseau. His French followers, rightly or wrongly, believed in an intimate connection between his theory of knowledge and his politics. In England, this connection is less evident. Of his two most eminent followers, Berkeley was politically unimportant, and Hume was a Tory who set forth his reactionary views in his History of England. But after the time of Kant, when German idealism began to influence English thought, there came to be again a connection between philosophy and politics. In the main, the philosophers who followed the Germans were conservative, while the Benthamites, who were radical, were in the tradition of Locke. The correlation, however, is not invariable. T.H. Green, for example, was a liberal but an idealist. Not only Locke's valid opinions, but even his errors were useful in practice. Take, for example, his doctrine as to primary and secondary qualities. The primary qualities are defined as those that are inseparable from body, and are enumerated as solidity, extension, figure, motion or rest, and number. The secondary qualities are all the rest, color, sounds, smells, etc. The primary qualities, he maintains, are actually in bodies. The secondary qualities, on the contrary, are only in the percipient. Without the eye, there would be no colors. Without the ear, no sounds, and so on. For Locke's view as to secondary qualities, there are good grounds, jaundice, blue spectacles, etc. But Berkeley pointed out that the same arguments apply to primary qualities. Ever since Berkeley, Locke's dualism on this point has been philosophically out of date. Nevertheless, it dominated practical physics until the rise of quantum theory in our own day. Not only was it assumed, explicitly or tacitly, by physicists, but it proved fruitful as a source of many very important discoveries. The theory that the physical world consists only of matter in motion was the basis of the accepted theories of sound, heat, light, and electricity. Pragmatically, the theory was useful, however mistaken it may have been theoretically. This is typical of Locke's doctrines. Locke's philosophy, as it appears in the essay, has throughout certain merits and certain demerits. Both alike were useful. The demerits are such only from a theoretical standpoint. He is always sensible and always willing to sacrifice logic rather than become paradoxical. He enunciates general principles which, as the reader can hardly fail to perceive, are capable of leading to strange consequences. But whenever the strange consequences seem about to appear, Locke blandly refrains from drawing them. To a logician, this is irritating. To a practical man, it is a proof of sound judgment. Since the world is what it is clear that valid reasoning from sound principles cannot lead to error. But a principle may be so nearly true as to deserve theoretical respect, and yet may lead to practical consequences which we feel to be absurd. There is, therefore, a justification for common sense in philosophy, but only as showing that our theoretical principles cannot be quite correct so long as their consequences are condemned by an appeal to common sense which we feel to be irresistible. The theorist may retort that common sense is no more infallible than logic. But this retort, though made by Berkeley and Hume, would have been wholly foreign to Locke's intellectual temper. A characteristic of Locke, which descended from him to the whole liberal movement, is lack of dogmatism. Some few certainties he takes over from his predecessors, our own existence, the existence of God, and the truth of mathematics. But wherever his doctrines differ from those of his forerunners, they are to the effect that truth is hard to ascertain, and that a rational man will hold his opinions with some measure of doubt. This temper of mind is obviously connected with religious toleration, with the success of parliamentary democracy, with laissez-faire, and with the whole system of liberal maxims. Although he is a deeply religious man, a devout believer in Christianity who accepts revelation as a source of knowledge, he nevertheless hedges round professed revelations with rational safeguards. On one occasion he says, "The bare testimony of revelation is the highest certainty." But on another he says, "Revelation must be judged by reason. Thus, in the end, reason remains supreme." His chapter Of Enthusiasm is instructive in this connection. Enthusiasm had not then the same meaning as it has now. It meant the belief in a personal revelation to a religious leader or to his followers. It was a characteristic of the sects that had been defeated at the Restoration. When there is a multiplicity of such personal revelations, all inconsistent with each other, truth, or what passes as such, becomes purely personal and loses its social character. Love of truth, which Locke considers essential, is a very different thing from love of some particular doctrine, which is proclaimed as the truth. One unerring mark of love of truth, he says, is not entertaining any proposition with greater assurance than the proofs it is built upon will warrant. Forwardness to dictate, he says, shows failure of love of truth. Enthusiasm, laying by reason, would set up revelation without it, whereby in effect it takes away both reason and revelation, and substitutes in the room of it the ungrounded fancies of a man's own brain. Men who suffer from melancholy or conceit are likely to have persuasions of immediate intercourse with the deity. Hence odd actions and opinions acquire divine sanction, which flatters men's laziness, ignorance, and vanity. He concludes the chapter with the maxim already quoted that revelation must be judged of by reason. What Locke means by reason is to be gathered from his whole book. There is, it is true, a chapter called Of Reason, but this is mainly concerned to prove that reason does not consist of syllogistic reasoning, and is summed up in the sentence, "God has not been so sparing to men to make them barely two-legged creatures, and left it to Aristotle to make them rational." Reason, as Locke uses the term, consists of two parts. First, an inquiry as to what things we know with certainty. Second, an investigation of propositions which it is wise to accept in practice, although they have only probability, and not certainty, in their favour. The grounds of probability, he says, are two: conformity with our own experience or the testimony of others' experience. The king of Siam, he remarks, ceased to believe what Europeans told him when they mentioned ice. In his chapter of Degrees of Assent, he says that the degree of assent we give to any proposition should depend upon the grounds of probability in its favor. After pointing out that we must often act upon probabilities that fall short of certainty, he says that the right use of this consideration is mutual charity and forbearance. Since, therefore, it is unavoidable to the greatest part of men, if not all, to have several opinions, without certain and indubitable proofs of their truth, and it carries too great an imputation of ignorance, lightness, or folly for men to quit and renounce their former tenets presently upon the offer of an argument which they cannot immediately answer and show the insufficiency of, it would, methinks, become all men to maintain peace and the common offices of humanity and friendship in the diversity of opinions, since we cannot reasonably expect that any one should readily and obsequiously quit his own opinion and embrace ours with a blind resignation to an authority which the understanding of man acknowledges not. For however it may often mistake, it can own no other guide but reason, nor blindly submit to the will and dictates of another. If he you would bring over to your sentiments be one that examines before he assents, you must give him leave at his leisure to go over the accounts again, and, recalling what is out of his mind, examine the particulars, to see on which side the advantage lies. And if he will not think over arguments of weight enough to engage him anew in so much pains, it is but what we do often ourselves in the like case. And we should take it amiss if others should prescribe to us what points we should study. And if he be one who wishes to take his opinions upon trust, how can we imagine that he should renounce those tenets which time and custom have so settled in his mind that he thinks them self-evident, and of an unquestionable certainty, or which he takes to be impressions he has received from God himself, or from men sent by him? How can we expect, I say, that opinions thus settled should be given up to the arguments or authority of a stranger or adversary, especially if there be any suspicion of interest or design, as there never fails to be where men find themselves ill-treated? We should do well to commiserate our mutual ignorance, and endeavour to remove it in all the gentle and fair ways of information, and not instantly treat others ill as obstinate and perverse because they will not renounce their own and receive our opinions, or at least those we would force upon them, when it is more than probable that we are no less obstinate in not embracing some of theirs. For where is the man that has uncontestable evidence of the truth of all that he holds, or of the falsehood of all he condemns, or can say that he has examined to the bottom all his own or other men's opinions? The necessity of believing without knowledge, nay, often upon very slight grounds, in this fleeting state of action and blindness we are in, should make us more busy and careful to inform ourselves than to restrain others. There is reason to think that if men were better instructed themselves, they would be less imposing on others. I have dealt hitherto only with the latest chapters of the essay, where Locke is drawing the moral from his earlier theoretical investigation of the nature and limitations of human knowledge. It is time now to examine what he has to say on this more purely philosophical subject. Locke is, as a rule, contemptuous of metaphysics. Apropos of some speculation of Leibniz's, he writes to a friend, "You and I have had enough of this kind of fiddling." The conception of substance, which was dominant in the metaphysics of his time, he considers vague and not useful, but he does not venture to reject it wholly. He allows the validity of metaphysical arguments for the existence of God, but he does not dwell on them, and seems somewhat uncomfortable about them. Whenever he is expressing new ideas and not merely repeating what is traditional, he thinks in terms of concrete detail rather than of large abstractions. His philosophy is piecemeal, like scientific work, not statuesque and all of a piece, like the great continental systems of the 17th century. Locke may be regarded as the founder of empiricism, which is the doctrine that all our knowledge, with the possible exception of logic and mathematics, is derived from experience. Accordingly, the first book of the essay is concerned in arguing, as against Plato, Descartes, and the Scholastics, that there are no innate ideas or principles. In the second book, he sets to work to show in detail how experience gives rise to various kinds of ideas. Having rejected innate ideas, he says, "Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast store which the busy and boundless fancy of man has painted on it with an almost endless variety? Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge?" To this I answer in one word, from experience. In that all our knowledge is founded, and from that it ultimately derives itself. Our ideas are derived from two sources, A, sensation, and B, perception of the operation of our own mind, which may be called internal sense. Since we can only think by means of ideas, and since all ideas come from experience, it is evident that none of our knowledge can antedate experience. Perception, he says, is the first step and degree towards knowledge, and the inlet of all the materials of it. This may seem to a modern almost a truism, since it has become part of educated common sense, at least in English-speaking countries. But in his day, the mind was supposed to know all sorts of things a priori, and the complete dependence of knowledge upon perception, which he proclaimed, was a new and revolutionary doctrine. Plato, in the Theaetetus, had set to work to refute the identification of knowledge with perception. And from his time onwards, almost all philosophers, down to and including Descartes and Leibniz, had taught that much of our most valuable knowledge is not derived from experience. Locke's thoroughgoing empiricism was therefore a bold innovation. The third book of the essay deals with words, and is concerned, in the main, to show that what metaphysicians present as knowledge about the world is purely verbal. Chapter 3 of General Terms takes up an extreme nominalist position on the subject of universals. All things that exist are particulars, but we can frame general ideas, such as man, that are applicable to many particulars, and to these general ideas we can give names. Their generality consists solely in the fact that they are, or may be, applicable to a variety of particular things. In their own being, as ideas in our minds, they are just as particular as everything else that exists. Chapter 6 of Book 3, of The Names of Substances, is concerned to refute the scholastic doctrine of essence. Things may have a real essence, which will consist of their physical constitution, but this is in the main unknown to us, and is not the essence of which scholastics speak. Essence, as we can know it, is purely verbal. It consists merely in the definition of a general term. To argue, for instance, as to whether the essence of body is only extension, or is extension plus solidity, is to argue about words. We may define the word body either way, and no harm can result so long as we adhere to our definition. Distinct species are not a fact of nature, but of language. They are distinct, complex ideas with distinct names annexed to them. There are, it is true, differing things in nature, but the differences proceed by continuous gradations. The boundaries of the species, whereby men sought them, are made by men. He proceeds to give instances of monstrosities, concerning which it was doubtful whether they were men or not. This point of view was not generally accepted until Darwin persuaded men to adopt the theory of evolution by gradual changes. Only those who have allowed themselves to be afflicted by the scholastics will realize how much metaphysical lumber it sweeps away. Empiricism and idealism alike are faced with a problem to which, so far, philosophy has found no satisfactory solution. This is the problem of showing how we have knowledge of other things than ourself and the operations of our own mind. Locke considers this problem, but what he says is very obviously unsatisfactory. In one place we are told, "Since the mind, in all its thoughts and reasonings, hath no other immediate object but its own ideas, which it alone does or can contemplate, it is evident that our knowledge is only conversant about them." And again, "Knowledge is the perception of the agreement or disagreement of two ideas." From this, it would seem to follow immediately that we cannot know of the existence of other people, or of the physical world. For these, if they exist, are not merely ideas in any mind. Each one of us, accordingly, must, so far as knowledge is concerned, be shut up in himself and cut off from all contact with the outer world. This, however, is a paradox, and Locke will have nothing to do with paradoxes. Accordingly, in another chapter, he sets forth a different theory, quite inconsistent with the earlier one. We have, he tells us, three kinds of knowledge of real existence. Our knowledge of our own existence is intuitive. Our knowledge of God's existence is demonstrative. And our knowledge of things present to sense is sensitive. In the next chapter, he becomes more or less aware of the inconsistency. He suggests that someone might say, if knowledge consists in agreement of ideas, the enthusiast and the sober man are on a level. He replies, not so where ideas agree with things. He proceeds to argue that all simple ideas must agree with things, since the mind, as has been showed, can by no means make to itself any simple ideas, these being all the product of things operating on the mind in a natural way. And as regards complex ideas of substances, all our complex ideas of them must be such and such only as are made up of such simple ones as have been discovered to coexist in nature. Again, we can have no knowledge except 1. By intuition, 2. By reason, examining the agreement or disagreement of two ideas, 3. By sensation, perceiving the existence of particular things. In all this, Locke assumes it known that certain mental occurrences, which he calls sensations, have causes outside themselves, and that these causes, at least to some extent and in certain respects, resemble the sensations which are their effects. But how, consistently with the principles of empiricism, is this to be known? We experience the sensations, but not their causes. Our experience will be exactly the same if our sensations arise spontaneously. The belief that sensations have causes, and still more, the belief that they resemble their causes, is one which, if maintained, must be maintained on grounds wholly independent of experience. The view that knowledge is the perception of the agreement or disagreement of two ideas is the one that Locke is entitled to, and his escape from the paradoxes that it entails is effected by means of an inconsistency so gross that only his resolute adherence to common sense could have made him blind to it. This difficulty has troubled empiricism down to the present day. Hume got rid of it by dropping the assumption that sensations have external causes. But even he retained this assumption whenever he forgot his own principles, which was very often. His fundamental maxim, no idea without an antecedent impression, which he takes over from Locke, is only plausible so long as we think of impressions as having outside causes, which the very word impression irresistibly suggests. And at the moments when Hume achieves some degree of consistency, he is wildly paradoxical. No one has yet succeeded in inventing a philosophy at once credible and self-consistent. Locke aimed at credibility and achieved it at the expense of consistency. Most of the great philosophers have done the opposite. A philosophy which is not self-consistent cannot be wholly true, but a philosophy which is self-consistent can very well be wholly false. The most fruitful philosophies have contained glaring inconsistencies, but for that very reason have been partially true. There is no reason to suppose that a self-consistent system contains more truth than one which, like Locke's, is obviously more or less wrong. Locke's ethical doctrines are interesting partly on their own account, partly as an anticipation of Bentham. When I speak of his ethical doctrines, I do not mean his moral disposition as a practical man, but his general theories as to how men act and how they should act. Like Bentham, Locke was a man filled with kindly feeling, who yet held that everybody, including himself, must always be moved, in action, solely by desire for his own happiness or pleasure. A few quotations will make this clear. Things are good or evil only in relation to pleasure or pain. That we call good, which is apt to cause or increase pleasure, or diminish pain in us. What is it moves desire? I answer, happiness, and that alone. Happiness, in its full extent, is the utmost pleasure we are capable of. The necessity of pursuing true happiness is the foundation of all liberty. The preference of vice to virtue is a manifest wrong judgment. the government of our passions is the right improvement of liberty. The last of these statements depends, it would seem, upon the doctrine of rewards and punishments in the next world. God has laid down certain moral rules. Those who follow them go to heaven, and those who break them risk going to hell. The prudent pleasure-seeker will therefore be virtuous. With the decay of the belief that sin leads to hell, it has become more difficult to make a purely self-regarding argument in favor of a virtuous life. Bentham, who was a free thinker, substituted the human lawgiver in place of God. It was the business of laws and social institutions to make a harmony between public and private interests, so that each man, in pursuing his own happiness, should be compelled to minister to the general happiness. But this is less satisfactory than the reconciliation of public and private interests effected by means of heaven and hell, both because lawgivers are not always wise or virtuous, and because human governments are not omniscient. Locke has to admit, what is obvious, that men do not always act in the way which, on a rational calculation, is likely to secure them a maximum of pleasure. We value present pleasure more than future pleasure, and pleasure in the near future more than pleasure in the distant future. It may be said, this is not said by Locke, that the rate of interest is a quantitative measure of the general discounting of future pleasures. If the prospect of spending $1,000 a year hence were as delightful as the thought of spending it today, I should not need to be paid for postponing my pleasure. Locke admits that devout believers often commit sins which, by their own creed, put them in danger of hell. We all know people who put off going to the dentist longer than they would if they were engaged in the rational pursuit of pleasure. Thus, even if pleasure or the avoidance of pain be our motive, it must be added that pleasures lose their attractiveness and pains their terrors in proportion to their distance in the future. Since it is only in the long run that, according to Locke, self-interest and the general interest coincide, it becomes important that men should be guided as far as possible by their long-run interests. That is to say, men should be prudent. Prudence is the one virtue which remains to be preached, for every lapse from virtue is a failure of prudence. Emphasis on prudence is characteristic of liberalism. It is connected with the rise of capitalism, for the prudent became rich while the imprudent became or remained poor. It is connected also with certain forms of Protestant piety. Virtue with a view to heaven is psychologically very analogous to saving with a view to investment. Belief in the harmony between private and public interests is characteristic of liberalism, and long survived the theological foundation that it had in Locke. Locke states that liberty depends upon the necessity of pursuing true happiness, and upon the government of our passions. This opinion he derives from his doctrine that private and public interests are identical in the long run, though not necessarily over short periods. It follows from this doctrine that given a community of citizens who are all both pious and prudent, they will all act, given liberty, in a manner to promote the general good. There will be no need of human laws to restrain them, since divine laws will suffice. The hitherto virtuous man who is tempted to become a highwayman will say to himself, "I might escape the human magistrate, but I could not escape punishment at the hands of the divine magistrate." He will accordingly renounce his nefarious schemes and live as virtuously as if he was sure of being caught by the police. Legal liberty, therefore, is only completely possible where both prudence and piety are universal. Elsewhere, the restraints imposed by the criminal law are indispensable. Locke states repeatedly that morality is capable of demonstration, but he does not develop this idea so fully as could be wished. The most important passage is, "Morality capable of demonstration." The idea of a supreme being, infinite in power, goodness, and wisdom, whose workmanship we are and on whom we depend, and the idea of ourselves as understanding rational beings, being such as are clear in us, would, I suppose, if duly considered and pursued, afford such foundations of our duty and rules of action as might place morality among the sciences capable of demonstration, wherein I doubt not, but from self-evident propositions, by necessary consequences, as incontestable as those in mathematics, the measures of right and wrong might be made out to any one that will apply himself with the same indifference and attention to the one as he does to the other of these sciences. The relation of other modes may certainly be perceived, as well as those of number and extension. And I cannot see why they should not also be capable of demonstration, if due methods were thought on to examine or pursue their agreement or disagreement. Where there is no property, there is no injustice, is a proposition as certain as any demonstration in Euclid. For the idea of property being a right to anything, and the idea to which the name injustice is given being the invasion or violation of that right, it is evident that these ideas being thus established, and these names annexed to them, I can as certainly know this proposition to be true as that a triangle has three angles equal to two right ones. Again, no government allows absolute liberty. The idea of government being the establishment of society upon certain rules or laws, which require conformity to them, and the idea of absolute liberty being for anyone to do whatever he pleases. I am as capable of being certain of the truth of this proposition as of any in the mathematics. This passage is puzzling because, at first, it seems to make moral rules dependent upon God's decrees, while in the instances that are given, it is suggested that moral rules are analytic. I suppose that, in fact, Locke thought some parts of his ethics analytic and others dependent upon God's decrees. Another puzzle is that the instances given do not seem to be ethical propositions at all. There is another difficulty which one could wish to see considered. It is generally held by theologians that God's decrees are not arbitrary, but are inspired by his goodness and wisdom. This requires that there should be some concept of goodness antecedent to God's decrees, which has led him to make just those decrees rather than any others. What this concept may be, it is impossible to discover from Locke. What he says is that a prudent man will act in such and such ways, since otherwise God will punish him. But he leaves us completely in the dark as to why punishment should be attached to certain acts rather than to their opposites. Locke's ethical doctrines are, of course, not defensible. Apart from the fact that there is something revolting in a system which regards prudence as the only virtue, there are other, less emotional objections to his theories. In the first place, to say that men only desire pleasure is to put the cart before the horse. Whatever I may happen to desire, I shall feel pleasure in obtaining it, but as a rule, the pleasure is due to the desire, not the desire to the pleasure. It is possible, as happens with masochists, to desire pain. In that case, there is still pleasure in the gratification of the desire, but it is mixed with its opposite. Even in Locke's own doctrine, it is not pleasure as such that is desired, since approximate pleasure is more desired than a remote one. If morality is to be deduced from the psychology of desire, as Locke and his disciples attempt to do, there can be no reason for deprecating the discounting of distant pleasures or for urging prudence as a moral duty. His argument, in a nutshell, is, we only desire pleasure, but in fact, many men desire not pleasure as such, but proximate pleasure. This contradicts our doctrine that they desire pleasure as such and is therefore wicked. Almost all philosophers, in their ethical systems, first lay down a false doctrine, and then argue that wickedness consists in acting in a manner that proves it false, which would be impossible if the doctrine were true. Of this pattern, Locke affords an example. Chapter 14. Locke's Political Philosophy. A. The Hereditary Principle. In the years 1689 and 1690, just after the Revolution of 1688, Locke wrote his two Treatises on Government, of which the second especially is very important in the history of political ideas. The first of these two treatises is a criticism of the doctrine of hereditary power. It is a reply to Sir Robert Filmer's Patriarcha or the Natural Power of Kings, which was published in 1680, but written under Charles I. Sir Robert Filmer, who was a devout upholder of the divine right of kings, had the misfortune to live till 1653, and must have suffered acutely from the execution of Charles I and the victory of Cromwell. But Patriarcha was written before these sad events, though not before the Civil War, so that it naturally shows awareness of the existence of subversive doctrines. Such doctrines, as Filmer points out, were not new in 1640. In fact, both Protestant and Catholic divines, in their contest with Catholic and Protestant monarchs respectively, had vigorously affirmed the right of subjects to resist tyrannical princes, and their writings supplied Sir Robert with abundant material for controversy. Sir Robert Filmer was knighted by Charles I, and his house is said to have been plundered by the parliamentarians 10 times. He thinks it not unlikely that Noah sailed up the Mediterranean and allotted Africa, Asia and Europe to Ham, Shem and Japheth, respectively. He held that, by the English constitution, the lords only give counsel to the king, and the commons have even less power. The king, he says, alone makes the laws, which proceed solely from his will. The king, according to Filmer, is perfectly free from all human control, and cannot be bound by the acts of his predecessors, or even by his own, for impossible it is in nature that a man should give a law unto himself. Filmer, as these opinions show, belonged to the most extreme section of the Divine Right party. Patriarcha begins by combating the common opinion that mankind is naturally endowed and born with freedom from all subjection, and at liberty to choose what form of government it please, and the power which any one man hath over others was at first bestowed according to the discretion of the multitude. This tenet, he says, was first hatched in the schools. The truth, according to him, is quite different. It is that originally God bestowed the kingly power upon Adam, from whom it descended to his heirs, and ultimately reached the various monarchs of modern times. Kings now, he assures us, either are or are to be reputed the next heirs to those first progenitors who were at first the natural parents of the whole people. Our first parent, it seems, did not adequately appreciate his privilege as universal monarch, for the desire of liberty was the first cause of the fall of Adam. The desire of liberty is a sentiment which Sir Robert Filmer regards as impious. The claims made by Charles I, and by his protagonists on his behalf, were in excess of what earlier times would have conceded to kings. Filmer points out that Parsons, the English Jesuit, and Buchanan, the Scotch Calvinist, who agree in almost nothing else, both maintain that sovereigns can be deposed by the people for misgovernment. Parsons, of course, was thinking of the Protestant Queen Elizabeth, and Buchanan of the Catholic Mary Queen of Scots. The doctrine of Buchanan was sanctioned by success, but that of Parsons was disproved by his colleague Campion's execution. Even before the Reformation, theologians tended to believe in setting limits to kingly power. This was part of the battle between the church and the state, which raged throughout Europe during most of the Middle Ages. In this battle, the state depended upon armed force, the church upon cleverness and sanctity. As long as the church had both these merits, it won. When it came to have cleverness only, it lost. But the things which eminent and holy men had said against the power of kings remained on record. Though intended in the interests of the Pope, they could be used to support the rights of the people to self-government. The subtle schoolmen, says Filmer, to be sure to thrust down the king below the Pope, thought it the safest course to advance the people above the king, so that the papal power might take the place of the regal. He quotes the theologian Bellarmine as saying that secular power is bestowed by men, that is, not by God, and is in the people unless they bestow it on a prince. Thus, Bellarmine, according to Filmer, makes God the immediate author of a democratical estate, which sounds to him as shocking as it would to a modern plutocrat to say that God is the immediate author of Bolshevism. Filmer derives political power not from any contract, nor yet from any consideration of the public good, but entirely from the authority of a father over his children. His view is that the source of regal authority is subjection of children to parents. That the patriarchs in Genesis were monarchs, that kings are the heirs of Adam, or at least are to be regarded as such, that the natural rights of a king are the same as those of a father, and that by nature sons are never free of paternal power, even when the son is adult and the parent is in his dotage. This whole theory seems to a modern mind so fantastic that it is hard to believe it was seriously maintained. We are not accustomed to deriving political rights from the story of Adam and Eve. We held it obvious that parental power should cease completely when the son or daughter reaches the age of 21, and that before that it should be very strictly limited, both by the state and by the right of independent initiative which the young have gradually acquired. We recognize that the mother has rights at least equal to those of the father. But apart from all these considerations, it would not occur to any modern man outside Japan to suppose that political power should be in any way assimilated to that of parents over children. In Japan, it is true, a theory closely similar to Filmer's is still held, and must be taught by all professors and schoolteachers. The Mikado can trace his descent from the sun goddess, whose heir he is. Other Japanese are also descended from her, but belong to cadet branches of her family. Therefore, the Mikado is divine, and all resistance to him is impious. This theory was, in the main, invented in 1868, but is now alleged in Japan to have been handed down by tradition ever since the creation of the world. The attempt to impose a similar theory upon Europe, of which attempt Filmer's Patriarcha is part, was a failure. Why? The acceptance of such a theory is in no way repugnant to human nature. For example, it was held, apart from Japan, by the ancient Egyptians and by the Mexicans and Peruvians before the Spanish conquest. At a certain stage of human development, it is natural. Stuart England had passed this stage, but modern Japan has not. The defeat of theories of divine right in England was due to two main causes. One was the multiplicity of religions. The other was the conflict for power between the monarchy, the aristocracy, and the higher bourgeoisie. As for religion, the king, since the reign of Henry VIII, was the head of the Church of England, which was opposed both to Rome and to most of the Protestant sects. The Church of England boasted of being a compromise. The preface to the Authorized Version begins, "It hath been the wisdom of the Church of England, ever since the first compiling of her public liturgy, to keep the mean between two extremes." On the whole, this compromise suited most people. Queen Mary and King James II tried to drag the country over to Rome, and the victors in the Civil War tried to drag it over to Geneva. But these attempts failed, and after 1688, the power of the Church of England was unchallenged.